and falling. And outside our studios and Friends Plaza in Urbana, it's 78 degrees.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu. Bevere offers Wi-Fi and is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
It's 12:40. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Our technical director is Jason Croft. The Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and its musicians are at an impasse. The players' contract expired at the end of last month. The symphony's facing a $20 million budget deficit, and it's seeking millions in concessions from the musicians. Both sides say they want to reach an agreement, but they've left the bargaining table, putting the orchestra's 68th season in jeopardy. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The musicians are locked out of their home at the Woodruff Arts Center. They're not being paid, and their health benefits have been cut off. No rehearsals are scheduled, but the symphony's youth programs are still taking place. Rachel Anders, who's 14 years old, practices a flute solo for her mentor, Christina Smith, principal flute for the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra.
So when you play your long notes, you can kind of play them spinnier, right? You can use your vibrato to do that. You can go...
Smith has been a member of the symphony for two decades, and she says the lockout is distressing.
It's been pretty devastating to the orchestra.
The Atlanta Symphony Management says it needs to make $5.2 million in cuts to the musicians' salaries over the next 2 years in order to balance the budget. The players say they've agreed to $4 million in cuts, but Smith says they can't go beyond that.
It's not right. We have been willing to cut ourselves to the bone. You can't have a great orchestra with when you lower the salary so much.
We cannot afford to spend more than we have.
The orchestra's president and CEO, Stanley Romenstein, says the symphony has run deficits for nearly a decade and can't continue to do so.
We share a common goal in wanting organizations that are artistically vibrant and financially stable. We're artistically vibrant right now, but we're not financially stable, and we need to take care of our business now so that we can still be in business tomorrow.
Romenstein says the musicians' salaries have increased more than 20% since 2006, while staff salaries have decreased. The players' union disputes that analysis, saying their salaries have gone up 16%, slightly more than the rate of inflation. Atlanta is not the only American orchestra facing problems. Cleveland musicians are working without a contract, and the Indianapolis Symphony has canceled concerts after contract talks broke down. Some here fear the same fate.
It's a challenge for boards and managements and musicians together to adapt to what is a changed business and cultural environment.
Jesse Rosen with the League of American Orchestras says ticket sales alone can't sustain orchestras, and some are experimenting with new ways to raise money and reach audiences. For example, the New York Philharmonic held a couple of concerts in the Park Avenue Armory, where audience seats were interspersed among musicians. The Cincinnati Orchestra is among those with tweet sections, and the Houston Orchestra partners with NASA on The Planets, a classical soundtrack for NASA's space images.
I don't think the field is far enough into that to know, you know, which of these things are going to work. There's a lot in play, and there's a lot of stuff being figured out.
Some suggest the Atlanta Symphony needs to get better at fundraising, but the symphony management says it's doing what it can. It points out the state is not helping much, providing the lowest per capita arts funding in the country. The musicians and management here both say they want to continue working toward a contract, although no new talks are scheduled. This week, Rachel Anders will try out for the Atlanta Symphony Youth Orchestra. But while the youth programs go on, it's unclear whether the symphony orchestra itself will have its season opening concert the first week of October. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
In the state of Oregon, the number of Latino Episcopalians has increased more than fivefold over the past decade. The church is also seeing considerably higher Latino membership in Nevada and Washington, D.C. Church leaders say the influx is in part due to a focused marketing campaign. From the Northwest News Network, Chris Lehman reports on the changing face of the Episcopal Church.
The 10 o'clock High Mass at Saints Peter and Paul Episcopal Church in Portland, Oregon, probably sounds a lot like it did when the congregation was founded nearly a century ago. Father Kurt Nielsen leads the liturgy, as he has for the past 17 years. He says attendance at the two morning services has been relatively flat. The real growth is in the afternoon. A few years ago, Saints Peter and Paul added a weekly Spanish-language Mass, or Misa. The English-speaking members of the congregation wanted to reach out to the growing number of Latinos in this working-class neighborhood. Nielsen says the new service took off quickly.
These are folks who were very unselfconscious about inviting one another to church.
Nielsen leads the Spanish-language service, too. He says many of the people who attend are former Catholics. So is Nielsen. He went to a Catholic seminary before joining the Episcopal Church nearly 30 years ago, and he thinks that might be helping him connect to the Latino members in his congregation.
I can still, if you will, speak a fluent Roman Catholic. You know, not that we're misrepresenting ourselves. We're very clear. This is the Episcopal Church. I tell them that I have a wife and children.
Married priests aren't the only major difference. Episcopalians have been making headlines for their increasingly liberal stance on social issues, such as same-sex marriage. But that isn't necessarily why Latinos are flocking to Episcopal churches in Oregon and elsewhere. For Jorge Chavez, it was as simple as moving into a new neighborhood and finding a nearby church that felt familiar.
To me, church is a church. It's still the same God, same beliefs. So for me, it's basically no difference.
In fact, the broader Episcopal Church itself notes that the similarity to Catholic services is one of the selling points for Latinos. Here in Oregon, Hispanics now make up about 6% of the Episcopal Church. A denomination-wide outreach plan notes that Hispanics represent a huge growth potential. The plan outlines strategies to reach Latinos, including focusing efforts on first and second generation women, who the church calls gatekeepers.
We need to have that intentionality.
Roberto Arciniega is head of Latino Ministries for the Episcopal Diocese of Oregon. He says the outreach is about staying vital and relevant in a multicultural society, and it's a shift in how his church views Latinos.
We have the tendency to stereotype, and many times we said, oh, poor Latinos, you know, they're coming here because they don't have anything to eat in their country, so let's give them a handout, let's give them something.
Arciniega says now Latino outreach is about inviting people to stay and be a part of the congregation. In Oregon, the efforts are paying off. 10 years ago, there were just 150 Latino Episcopalians. Now there are more than 800. But nationally, according to the Pew Research Center, just 5% of all Hispanics attend a mainline Protestant church. The vast majority are Roman Catholic. Back at Saints Peter and Paul in Portland, Steve Hisco munches on a snack during a coffee hour between the English and Spanish language services. The conversation around us is entirely in English. Nobody from the Spanish service has showed up early to socialize. Hisco says that's not unusual.
We had a barbecue here on the lawn a month or so ago, and both congregations came, but the Latinos mostly sat with the Latinos, and the English sat with the Anglos.
So there's still some bridge building to do. For his part, Hisco says he's learning Spanish. And remember the music we heard earlier from the Spanish language Mass? That was Hisco on guitar. For NPR News, I'm Chris Lehman.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is available at 351-7958.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 11th of September, 2012. It was on this date, 1941, ground was broken for the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia. In July of that same year, Brigadier General and Engineer Brian B. Somerville had summoned two of his subordinates. He told them to draw up plans for an office building four stories tall, to cover 4 million square feet, and to house 40,000 War Department workers. Gave them the assignment on a Thursday afternoon, said he wanted the plans on his desk by Monday. Plans were there on Monday. Construction began 2 months later. 16 months later, the Pentagon was complete. It was on this date, 1792, the Hope Diamond was stolen. It came from a mine in India. It was originally about 112 carats, but King Louis XIV of France had it recut into a 67-carat heart shape, which he wore on a ribbon around his neck. But during the French Revolution, on this date, 1792, the treasury was looted, the crown jewels were stolen, and the Hope Diamond was lost. It turned up in London 20 years later. A stone which is rumored to be cursed. It is said that the merchant who sold it to Louis XIV had stolen it from a statue of a Hindu idol. He was later torn apart by wild dogs, and subsequent owners have suffered financial ruin and personal tragedies and violent deaths. It now rests in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. It's the birthday of William Sidney Porter. O. Henry, born Greensboro, North Carolina, 1862. O. Henry, who said, "You can't write a story that's got any life in it by sitting at a writing table and thinking. You've got to get out into the streets, into the crowds, talk with people, and feel the rush and throb of real life. That's the stimulant for a story writer." It's the birthday of D.H. Lawrence, David Herbert Lawrence, born Eastwood, England, 1885, author of Sons and Lovers, Women in Love, Lady Chatterley's Lover. D.H. Lawrence, who wrote, "No form of love is wrong so long as it is love, and you yourself honor what you are doing." And it's the birthday of Jessica Mitford, born in Oxfordshire, England, 1917, one of the six Mitford sisters who grew up in a wealthy right-wing family. Two of the sisters became fascists. Jessica and her sister Nancy became socialists. They traveled in high circles. When they were very young, they met Adolf Hitler and thought about assassinating him and did not, and bitterly regretted it years afterward. Here's a poem for today by Charles Darling, entitled At the County Fair, 1956. For a nickel, a machine called an expression of faith would take your dime and squash it. All tubes and gears and lights, the thing would groan, squeak, fart.